granddaughters, watch your cars.
Well, welcome back to Action RC, the podcast series taking you inside RC racing, both now and over the 40 plus years of its history. This week, we're talking to one of the world's best known racers, a two-time IFMA world champion. I think it's 17 times Royal National Champion, six times at the iconic Neo Buggy race in the UK, which we'll talk about. He's driven for Team Associated at Kyosho Techno and now is a part of the new Miyako project. And he's just announced his retirement as a full-time pro racer to concentrate on other parts of the industry and his own kind of life and family. He is, of course, Jared Tebow. You've read the headline. You know what the episode is. Jared, by the wonders of technology, having navigated the time zones and from the other side of the planet, welcome to the show. It is great to have a chat with you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. Really looking forward to this. And thanks for wanting to chat and inviting me to come on here.
Oh, it's a delight. Now, before we get into the RC stuff, I think you were at the US MotoGP last week. How was it?
Yeah, it was incredible. I've been one other time. I went to my first MotoGP race in 2019 at COTA and really enjoyed it. And yeah, I had the opportunity to go again. And this time my wife came with me and she has never been to something like that. She's been to a couple Supercrosses with me in the past. But yeah, we had such a fun weekend. The racing was awesome. Weather was pretty good, had some kind of coldish days a little bit, but yeah, weather was good. And yeah, we had such a good time. And actually, there's a guy that's really into RC from Spain, Jose Bowie, and he actually owns a Moto3 team. He's had it for 10 years. And so yeah, he invited us to hang out with him and his team a little bit. So that was extra special. Yeah, we went out to dinner with the whole team, got to meet everybody, and then got to see a little bit behind the scenes and, you know, go in their garage stall and check out their bikes and the mechanics and the engineer and everything, you know, doing some of the work behind the scenes. So that was pretty cool.
When you get inside the garage and you see that MotoGP from behind the scenes, do you notice anything that you kind of go, oh, this is just like RC? Are there some similarities that you notice?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. The weird part, I think, with RC as far as like motorsports goes, Europe's a little bit different, but like especially in the US, is the driver is normally always their own mechanic as well.
Yeah.
You know, so we're working on our own cars and doing a lot of stuff to where, you know, we can't really just focus solely on the driving. So that's a pretty big difference. That's just pretty noticeable. You know, the riders are speaking with engineers and looking at data and things like that. You know, which is really cool. Like I think, you know, RC, as far as like professional drivers, would be able to benefit a little bit if we were in a position to where, you know, the drivers could focus more so just on the driving aspect.
Yeah.
But you know, mindset, going over data, like thinking about lines, thinking about how the equipment's working, all stuff like that is very similar. You know, I'm really big at like analyzing things. So,
yeah.
You know, I watched one of the practices and, you know, I told Jose, I was like, oh man, you know, it sounded like, David's bike was hitting the rev limiter before any other bikes. And, you know, like, are you guys messing with the gearing or like, you know, was, you know, did you guys notice that? And it was kind of funny. He's like, oh yeah, you know, they did kind of notice that. So we are changing the gearing. And, That was pretty cool to see. You got to see him take the transmission apart and change the gearing and stuff in there. Yeah, I mean, a lot of motorsports is really similar. You know, just a team atmosphere, people trying to work, you know, work together and trying to study everything and trying to figure out, you know, the best way to go around the track and the fastest way. So it was cool to see the behind the scenes. We got to meet the riders too and kind of see them debrief with the engineer, which was pretty neat.
I won't get started on this because I will talk for hours about it, but I did just spend the weekend, the Easter weekend, at Bathurst in Australia, one of Australia's most famous racetracks, inside the garage with a race team, and loved the experience of being at a racetrack inside the garage, part of the crew of a dozen or so running a car in a 6 hour enduro. And yeah, I think you've made a really good assessment of what's similar and what's different. And there's a lot to like about the team environment, as you say, and that, being a part of a dozen people trying to run the car and support the drivers and, pore over the data and all of those sorts of things. Yeah, it's very cool. We're all motor racing fans at heart, right? If we could be, we would be.
Oh, of course. Even like after the race, seeing all their teardown, I thought that was actually really cool. We had paddock passes, and so after the race, we got to run down like the front straightaway and watch the podium and them spray the champagne and all that stuff. At COTA, I don't know if they do it at all the races, but they open up the track to everybody right after the race. And so then we're walking through the paddock afterwards, and you're seeing all the teams pack everything up. So that was pretty cool. They all have these similar like big metal cases. We got to see bikes getting put in there, and then even just all the other equipment, all like the banners and all their screens and their toolboxes and all the computer equipment and everything. That was pretty cool to see it all packed up like that so quickly after it ended too.
There's a real system and an art to some of that, isn't there? Incredible racetrack,
Yeah.
COTA, right? The way that racetrack rises and falls and, is lives on the environment. It must be a great place to go and watch a race live in the flesh as well.
Yeah, I think so. We walked around quite a bit and checked out different areas, and I thought it was awesome. They say a lot of the motorcycle riders don't necessarily like that track. It's more of like a car track. And it's pretty rough. So Jose was like, yeah, that's kind of like the Silver State track for MotoGP.
Nice for him to put it in that language. Oh, I have to get back there for F1 and see. It's probably a racetrack that's designed more for an F1 style of an event. Yeah. Jared, let's get into the RC side of things and let's start with the most recent news. You've just in the last few weeks announced that after I think it's 24 or so years of racing pretty hardcore full time, you're stepping back from that professional racing, that full time pro racing. Can you just, I mean, give us a bit of a background to that decision. Where did it come from? What does it mean for you, for your future, for your family, all those sorts of things? Tell me about this decision.
My first year as a professional was year 2000. So working on my 23rd year now. I've kind of tossed the idea around of retirement all the way back to like 2018, I would say. Just feeling a little bit burnt out at different times. I think mainly it's just the stress of just all the highs and lows. I think just naturally I'm a pretty emotional person. And so, any type of motorsports or competition really, like, it's such a roller coaster. Like, you never are like in the middle. You're either at like ultimate high or ultimate low normally. There's not a whole lot of middle ground. And it's crazy too, like the lows feel like they just last so much longer. Like the highs even seem like they're just so short-lived, because you always, a race win, depending on when it is in the season, can only, last, maybe a week. And even sometimes, like, we race multiple classes, so I've had a win, only last a few hours, and then
That's right.
you have another class, and then you have a bad race, and you're just like, boom, you're back to the low. And so I think just over time, like, that's just kind of worn me down a little bit. And then 2018, I was pretty like unsure what I was gonna do. My Kyosho deal was coming to an end, and they were kind of in the financial state to where they couldn't really offer me anything. And So there wasn't a whole lot of options really as far as teams go. So I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I got my real estate license and I bought an investment property to flip, and I was maybe just going to, retire then and move into being a real estate agent. And then kind of last second, a spot opened up at Techno, and so I was excited about that. Joined Techno and then was there for 4 years, and it was going good and I was enjoying my racing and but I knew like my time was starting to get closer. And one thing that I've kind of always thought is like I never want to be forced into retirement based on like my speed or my skill level. I don't want to have to stop racing because I'm not competitive anymore.
You wanted to have
I
control of that
wanted,
decision.
yeah, I wanted to be able to like make that decision on my own, to feel like I kind of stopped on my own terms instead of like being forced. And then I also didn't really want to go down racing where, your results are really starting to tumble and almost like, like I'll use like Chad Reed kind of for an example. Not to take anything away from his career, but like in my opinion, he just went a little bit long to where you almost like forget of some of those really like good memories of like speed and stuff. So I didn't want that to happen either. And then it was kind of a spur of the moment really decision. Like when I Techno, they wanted to do something different after my 2 year contract was coming up, and so they wanted to hire Mayfield and not keep me on. I think just mainly they didn't think that I could really win the races that they wanted to be winning, which unfortunately, I kind of understood where they were coming from a little bit with that, but kind of again, there wasn't like a whole lot of options and things really for me to do. And then kind of late again, this Miyako opportunity popped up, and even from the beginning, it wasn't really like I'm like a star driver. Like it's pretty clear David is their star driver, and I was kind of brought on more to help do Miyako in the US. And then be a driver still, for it was most likely going to be like 2 years where I'm still doing the big races and things like that. And but it wasn't like I'm brought on really to just be like a star driver or anything like that. And I was actually, it was while I was at DNC, I went a little bit early and just to get some more running. We had like a hot race event before DNC, and the trip was just so long. And I think it was actually on Wednesday. So after it was after the practice day or during the practice day, I just kind of just made a decision like, man, I'm done. Like this will be my last DNC. Like I'm just kind of done with it. And it actually started on New Year's Day. So I really needed to start running these Miyako cars, and it's hard to kind of run in secret and stuff. Especially like in the Midwest, my local tracks closed during the winter. And so like the weekend that kind of crossed over New Year's, I went down to Texas, and so I could get some driving in. And I was driving home like during the night when it hit New Year's. And that was like maybe the first time I was away from my wife on New Year's. And it kind of just crossed my mind, like, man, what am I doing? Why am I here? Why am I, this is kind of silly. So I think that maybe got my mind started a little bit. And then, like I said, it was Wednesday at DNC, and it just kind of hit me like, this feels like it's the right time. So I told Megan, my wife, I was like, I'm gonna be done after this year. Like, this is 100% my last DNC. And I didn't tell anyone else, and then I just put like a little kind of hashtag teaser on my post before the main, and just put like hashtag last DNC or something. And
To see
not
who's
really
paying
that,
attention, right?
yeah, just to see who's paying attention. And not many people did. And I think there was a couple things, maybe a couple people kind of said. And then I had talked to J I think Joseph actually said something. We're at the Airbnb house, and it was like Monday morning or something, and we're all kind of saying bye, and he said something, about that. And then I kind of told him like, yeah, I think I'm done. This will be my last year racing. I don't want to do these big races anymore and travel so much. And he was super supportive of it and stuff. And so then, yeah, I just took a little bit more time, and I wanted to do it. I wanted to make the post before PNB, but I had planned to do it closer after DNC. But it was pretty scary just to kind of, make that more public. But yeah, I think the it's a big thing too. It takes a certain mentality to be at the top. Like they say, like, oh, nice guys never win and stuff. And I don't fully believe that, but there's definitely some truth to that as well. And it's not that you can't be like a nice person. It's just that you have to be like really selfish to be at the top. And like, whatever the motorsports or whatever it is that you're doing, I would say even as far as like even in business, to really be at like an elite level, you have to be pretty darn selfish, and things have to really revolve around you. And I've had a hard time kind of like balancing that, I would say, especially becoming a parent, and then now like as they get older. And it's just a difficult balance. And it's hard for me to not be selfish at home and then like mix in some work and then go to the track and then have to like kind of try to like turn that back on. But then you also want to be friendly with, like now I have my business, and a lot of people come up and talk to me, and it's just difficult, like when you're at the races and you're there to win, like you really can't talk to people, and you can't really be that friendly if you want to be at the top. And so I think for me, like that type of personality is not really who I am. And so that sacrifice to me now is not worth it. And so I think that was probably the biggest thing in my brain, where like winning a race doesn't do enough good for me to sacrifice not being able to be myself, if that makes sense.
The outcome is not worth the sacrifice in that sense. Jared,
Yeah.
you talked about being quite an emotional person. What, tell me a little bit about the emotions in the aftermath of making that decision. Has it been, I mean, is relief the overwhelming thing? Is it, has there been moments of what have I done? What's been the kind of emotional journey of the last couple of weeks, including that, that Psycho Nitro blast where they, put together a tribute for you and all of that. That kind of stuff. Tell me a little bit about that emotional journey of the last few weeks.
Yeah, honestly, which it makes me feel good. Like I felt a big relief. I felt a really big relief after, mainly like after doing the post. I was scared kind of leading up to it a little bit, like, man, like am I gonna change my mind? Or, and the big part too is just the financial side. You know,
Yeah.
some people kind
Yeah.
of forget, you know, like I race for my living. That's how my house bill is paid. That's how groceries are bought for my family. That's how everything's paid for. So that side is pretty scary. But, you know, the last 4 years, I would say we've really built up JTP more and more to where, you know, that's going to be a little bit more sustainable for us. So that I thought the pressure of the income part would be a little bit more scary to me, but I feel that it's going to work out. And so the emotion side has been relief. Like I haven't really thought like, oh man, I'm going to regret this, or you know, did I say this too early or something like that. And then, you know, all the people like that reached out to me after I made that post was really cool. And just so many comments and text messages and Facebook messages and stuff that really made me feel like super proud. You know, whatever you do, you always want to, you know, do a good job and do the best that you can. And you know, just all the different things that people said made me just feel pretty good. Like, you know, I did a good job, and you know, a lot of people appreciated what I did. So that kind of made like some of that sacrifice, you know, definitely feel worth it. And then the tribute video at PNB was awesome. I had no idea they were doing that. And you know, like we're doing the normal PNB thing, like through the smoke and whatever, and we're lining up the straightaway. I'm like, oh, this is kind of weird. Like, what's going on? And then it was like, as soon as Lance started talking, I was like, oh crap,
I
what are they about to
know what's
do?
happening here.
Yeah. And so, like, at first, I was like pretty uncomfortable, felt pretty awkward. Like, everyone's kind of looking at me, and I'm like, you know, like, where am I supposed to be looking? And the cameras are kind of going around. And, but once it started playing and everything like that, I thought that was really cool. That was really special. I was trying not to like tear up and start crying and stuff. So I tears can flow from my eyes pretty darn easily. So I tried to hold it together. I did for the most part, and that was really cool. And you know, having a lot of people there that have been around my career, I mean, you know, like me and Mayfield, Cavallari wasn't there, but you know, me and us three, like we've pretty much gone through like our whole lives together. I mean, me and Cavallari started racing each other when we were 13, and we were really good friends, you know, starting at age 13. So, you know, like we literally went through, you know, high school stuff together, like, you know, our first girlfriends together, like, you know, going, spending weeks at his house in the summer and going to the beach and riding bikes together. And then, you know, like our first national championships, our first world championships, you know, getting married, now having kids. Like all three of us have like shared all those experiences together. And so, that was cool to have, like Mayfield there. And you know, he kind of gave me a hug after. And you know, I think even though like at the races now we don't talk as much as like we did when we were kids, you know, I think some of those guys and some of those times I'm definitely gonna miss. Just some of the battles and stuff on the track, I'm definitely gonna miss that for sure. But yeah, it's been a great experience so far.
There's a thousand questions, Jared, I want to ask you about all of that,
Yeah.
but two in particular. Let's start with the easy one. How on earth did you get up on the driver's stand after that presentation at PNB and then drive your car in the main? Is that was that a kind of was it easy to refocus, or did you kind of just need a minute to kind of get yourself together?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it definitely took, you know, some focus off, but also it really just like made me pretty happy. You know, I think just as far as for me personally, I've always been really hard on myself. I would say I'm a perfectionist, so I really expect a lot out of myself, and you know, the results the last few years like haven't really been what I wanted or what I feel like sometimes I should be getting. So, you know, hearing them like read all the races that I won and seeing pictures of certain races, like it gave me some confidence. Like, man, you know, like I'm not the type of person to really, you know, I don't like brag about my career or really, you know, even really like look back on a lot of that stuff. So it felt really good. Like I went on the driver's stand feeling
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
Like, man, you know, I really wanted to have a good race. And actually I got a good start and moved up to third and was fighting pretty good. But I just didn't gel with that track. Like all week, I did not gel with the track layout.
It did look pretty wild.
How my cars drove or something.
Yeah.
So that was disappointing, like to have all that and then to just have kind of a crummy race was a bummer, but I didn't let that ruin the moment at all. And it was cool. You know, I was definitely like really trying to just like hold my emotions back a little bit. But it was, you know, I was extremely grateful that they did that for me.
Yeah. The other question I want to ask you, and it's at risk of going, you know, we've only just met, so at risk of going really deep, really fast, you know, as I listen to your story, you know, in the last 10 minutes, it strikes me that your whole life and your whole adult life and even those formative teenage years, everything has been around RC. And so this, you know, self-image of Jared Tebow, the RC racer, the pro RC racer, the world champion, all of that, has been your life from 13, you know, to now. And I guess that, you know, I'm sitting here listening going, the decision to leave all of that in which your whole life has been shaped, your personality has kind of been shaped, you know, your self-image of who you are has been shaped by this sport and by your participation in it. I guess I'm kind of sitting here going, man, that is a big, big deal, you know, for you to kind of be brave enough to step out of, you know, this thing that has, you know, really shaped a lot of your whole life. It just, I don't even know if there's a question there, but I'm just listening to your story going, this is a big moment for you, in your life, not just in RC.
Yeah. I think it is. I think it's probably bigger than, you know, maybe I realize, you know, like I haven't really, I mean, I've thought about it a little bit, like what you're saying. But I think too, it goes like, I don't really live my life day to day, as you know, where I'm, you know, some successful racer or something like, you know, a lot of my, you know, when I was younger, I mean, I raced professionally all through high school, and no one that I went to high school really even knew what I did. I missed 30 days of school a year, and most people thought I raced dirt bikes.
Yeah.
I didn't really talk about it. You know, I wasn't like bragging to people that, you know, I'm in magazines or that I'm traveling around the world or anything like that. Like most people didn't really know like where I went. You know, maybe some close friends, like my teachers and stuff knew, but, you know, I don't really live like most of my friends that, you know, I hang out with at home, like they're not really like racers you know, they're not really RC people. So, I haven't tried to like have my whole life completely revolve around that.
Yeah, good.
But, you know, I think it will be a little bit, you know, not to sound selfish or anything, but it's nice when, you know, like people want to, you know, just be nice to you or you're kind of, you know, not like a special person, but, you know, people treat, you know, when I go to an RC track, I get treated a little bit differently because of who I am. You know, and that is a little bit nice sometimes. So I don't know if maybe I'll miss that a little bit, but you know, I don't, I would, you know, there's some people that like want to be famous to be famous, and that's just like that's what they want to do. Like I don't really like that side of it. You know, not that I'm famous or anything, but it's, you know, I'm not looking, I don't get any type of like fulfillment by that or anything really special by that. So
I mean, I'm sure you'll be able to just drop down to a racetrack anytime you want that little kind of bit of a boost, that little bit of a hit of
yeah.
but for now you can just be Jared the dad, Jared the husband, Jared the friend, all of those things. Mate, let's take you a
Yeah,
little
and
bit of
I
time.
think too, I'm not gonna just like drop out of RC either. I don't, you know, I don't think that's the plan. Like, you know, I've tossed it around. I'm kind of, I mean, just to be honest, you know, like right now I'm kind of all over the place. You know, one day I'm like, man, I still, you know, like I want to be involved and, you know, I want to go to some local races and I like helping people, which I really do enjoy that part. But then there's other days where I'm just like, man, I'm so sick of RC cars. Like if I never had to see one again, I wouldn't be that sad. And you know, so it's like I've tossed around the idea of, you know, maybe just fully getting out and starting a career in something else. And but I don't think that's the right thing to do. And so I think that would do my whole career a little bit of an injustice. So I think I'm going to be sticking around quite a bit.
Well, let's take a little bit of a moment, you know, to kind of recognizing this point in your career. We've talked a bit about what's led up to it. So let's take a few minutes, you know, in this conversation to reflect back over some of it and pick out some of the highlights and a little bit about how you got to be where you are, some of those things. And then we'll come back at the end and talk a little bit more about where to from here. So, Jared, just, you know, take me right back to the beginning. I think we're in the late 90s. How does RC get started for you, and how quickly does it become a serious competitive project?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting how it all got started. Basically, I was racing motocross. I wanted to be, well, I'll take a little bit step back. So my dad road raced street bikes. We live by Willow Springs Raceway, which is a road course out in California. Basically, if you live in the US and you see a car commercial, that's where it's made. And so we were like 2 miles from the racetrack. My dad road raced, and he was good. He rode for Suzuki. I wouldn't call him a professional because he had another job, but you know, he raced you know, in the premier category and things like that. So I was always around a racetrack racing motorcycles. He wanted me to go that direction, but I wanted to do motocross instead. So, I started racing motocross when I was 6, I think, and you
Pretty
know,
young.
took that really serious and raced up until I was probably, yes, I had to be like 11. And once I started getting kind of around like that 9, 10, 11 range, I started getting a lot more injuries, started breaking bones, and that burned me out really quickly. I was pretty over it. So I was like, man, I'm done racing these dirt bikes. So my parents were divorced, and my mom lived in a town like an hour and a half or so away from my dad. And so like I mainly lived with her, and then he would come and visit me, you know, a couple days a week, and I would have like every other weekend or something with him. And so he came to visit, and we would always drive by this like hobby shop. And so it was one of those weekdays where he came to take me to dinner, and we're like, oh man, let's like check out this hobby shop. So we went in there, and they had a track in the back, and it was called Hobby Haven, I believe,
okay,
in
that
Bakersfield.
Rings a bell. Yeah.
Yeah, and so they had a track in the back, and there was someone driving a gas truck, and I was just like, oh my gosh, that is what I want. And we just thought it was the coolest thing, and we hadn't really had RC cars. I think my dad had like an RC10T at some point when I was a kid. I remember like trying to jump it in the backyard or something, but we didn't know that they had tracks, and we had never been to a track or anything. And so, yeah, we talking to the people in the hobby shop, and, you know, so I had to be, I guess, 11 at that time, because it was close to my 12th birthday. And they're like, oh, he's way too young to have a gas-powered car. Like, he needs an electric car and this and that. And my dad's like, no way. Like, we're getting a gas car. We're not getting anything. And so they were trying to steer us a different direction, you know. And so then they had a used RC10 GT there. And for my birthday, my dad got me that. You know, had everything, radio and car and starter box, like everything we needed. And so that was in like March of 99. And yeah, I just started practicing a whole bunch, and pretty early on, like I was comfortable driving it. You know, I picked it up pretty easily, figured out the jumping and, you know, how to go around the track and stuff. And just practiced a ton, and we definitely weren't very well off or anything like that. So, you know, my dad was basically like, oh, you know, we can only race one class. And so we just had that one truck, and he actually raced at the beginning. So like I would race Sportsman and he would race Expert or something like that.
Yeah, I think.
Can't exactly remember at which time, but he stopped racing. And yeah, like I picked up pretty darn quick. So I raced at, oh, it was called Racer's Haven. Racer's I think Haven. I might've said yeah. Hobby Haven, yeah. Racer's Haven. And then I also raced at Hot Rod Hobbies,
okay,
which Jimmy Babcock now owns. And so I practiced a ton. Like I was practicing 3 or 4 times a week, you know, racing Friday and Saturday, Racer's Haven had some type of like summer series or something. And so I started in Sportsman, and I was winning like right away in Sportsman, but I stayed in Sportsman the whole time. And so this was like kind of towards the end of summer. So, you know, I had only owned an RC car for a few months, and the final round of the series, Matt Francis, who was, you know, TLR's, like top driver next to Brian Kinwald at the time.
Yeah.
He came to the final round of the series. And so it's funny, I raced Sportsman and Expert, and I actually won both, and I beat Matt Francis. And so like everyone was like shocked. I mean, you know, he had no idea who I was or anything. And so that was pretty cool. And then Hot Rod Hobbies had a race in like November. It was the Hot Rod Shootout, so a lot of the pros went there. Associated had, I think, Billy Easton, Pavitas, Chad Bradley, I think Greg Degani, then Losey. I even think Kinwald was there. Kinwald and Matt Francis, and I think Cavallari was there, and Jimmy Babcock when he was racing. And so that was like my first big race that I did. We had no sponsors or anything. And one of the rounds I was leading, and I was going to TQ, and I stuck a pipe with like one turn to go. Oof. On the last lap.
Ouch.
And so I didn't TQ, but Steve O'Donnell was there. And so he was actually my first sponsor. And so, yeah, he, you know, really kind of like took me in, took me under his wing, and helped me get like a 50% deal with Associated and some other help and stuff. And then so in 2000, I went to DNC for the first time, still just racing gas truck. We couldn't afford to race any other classes. And had super bad luck in qualifying, was in like the F main, and then bumped all the way up to the A main. And this was at the big races, they didn't have sportsman or expert. So there was just one class, gas truck. And gas truck actually at that point was a little bit more popular than 1/8 scale. So I would say like gas truck was almost the premier class over 8 scale buggy. And so I bumped all the way into the A and was battling for the podium position, I'm pretty sure, with Pavitas, and ended up getting fourth. But that was really big for me. And so then I got a couple more sponsorship help and things like that. And then the next race was Silver State. And so we went to Silver State, and we still, like, we weren't pitting with Team Associate or anything. my dad was kind of shy, and, you know, we just kind of did our own thing. And like, I was young. I mean, I think at DNC, I was still 12, and I turned 13 just before Silver State. And Silver State, I TQ'd Gas Truck, which was awesome. And then Thunder Tiger, Richard Saxton, he was a big help early on in my career, too. He was driving Thunder Tiger at that time. Okay. And so after I TQ Gas Truck, he had talked to the people at Thunder Tiger, and they were, you know, wanting to bring me on the team so that I could race 8 scale. Okay. And so they gave me like a full 100% sponsorship, travel paid and everything for me and my dad. And Richard actually gave me like his practice car or something there so that I could start practicing. And so I got the 8 scale, and at that time, you know, I'd only been racing for about a year, and we did some practicing and stuff. And then
I should not be laughing, Jared, but this is, it's such an incredible story of, you know, a 12-year-old kid shows up and, you know, a year later you're winning the biggest races in the US against, it's extraordinary. It's an extraordinary story. You must have, I mean, were you thinking at this point, this is easy, RC is so easy? It's an extraordinary story of natural talent, I guess, is what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, as a, you know, as a kid going through it, I didn't really think anything of it.
Yeah. You're just doing what you're doing.
I love driving.
Yeah.
I love driving. I love just competition.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the cool thing too was like growing up in motocross, you know, everything's like age group. And then it was like, you know, I can compete with like the world's best at whatever age. Like there's no age limit.
Yeah.
And so like on the driver's stand, you know, and it was good and bad. Like I stood up for myself, and, you know, I think, you know, some of the people were definitely upset that there was some 13-year-old kid that they didn't even know my name that was beating them. Cause yeah, I mean, that's pretty unheard of really in any type of industry. And, but you know, I didn't really think too much of it. You know, I don't really ever remember thinking like, oh, this is easy. Or even like, you know, I'm good or anything like that. Yeah. It was just like,
you're just doing it.
I don't have any memories of thinking like that. No. But then, yeah, so my first 8 scale race, actually, like, I don't even think I did any club races. I don't know. I maybe did, like, a club race at Hemet or something, but I can't remember or recall doing any races before I went to the Roar Nationals in 2000 and raced 8 scale for the first time. And it's funny because now that's actually my father-in-law's track. So that track was out here in Kansas City, Missouri, where I live now. He doesn't have the track anymore, but, and so that race, I qualified straight into the A main in gas truck, but I qualified into the C main in 8 scale buggy. bumped out of the sea, was leading the B main and flamed out after my last pit stop. And then I was battling Adam Drake for the final bump spot. And actually, I remember I passed Adam on the last lap to take the last transfer spot.
Wow.
So I bumped into the A main and eight scale buggy also. And then I had an incredible main and almost won. I finished second, pretty close behind Kinwald. So that was the year that Brian Kinwald won. And yeah, my first ever time racing eight scale, I got second at the Roar Nats and was like 10 seconds behind him from winning. So that was ridiculous. Pretty cool.
Yeah, that's very cool. That is very cool. What an experience. Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, so that's kind of how it all got started.
Yeah, yeah.
Let
me just pick out a couple of questions out of that before we kind of charge on, because we're going to arrive at World Championship Racing in a moment. But two things I want to ask you about. Firstly, you're the first person I've spoken to who in a sense grew up or came into RC racing gas truck. You know, the more common way in is maybe two-wheel drive electric buggy, or, you know, for those that got started earlier in the 80s, it was 12 scale on road, those sorts of time-worn routes into developing as a driver. You came through gas truck. What did you learn racing gas truck in those first few years that do you think has stood you in good stead the rest of your career? What habits did you learn racing gas truck that have formed you as a driver?
I think the biggest thing that probably helped me was learning to be really good on the brakes, to be like exceptionally well in gas truck, you had to be really good with the brakes. So to be able to do like all the big jumps, you had to be able to have strong enough brakes to, you know, get the front end down. So that was like one of the big things I would say in like my gas truck career, is like I could always do all the jumps. Some people struggle with, you know, doing all the jumps, especially like later as the tracks were more so built for the eight scale buggies.
Yeah.
But I learned how to drive with a lot of brakes. And so gas truck, you know, you only have the rear brake, and we drove on looser tracks and stuff. So I really learned how to like feather the brakes. So even now, I can feather the brake the same way people like feather the throttle.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I would say that's probably the biggest thing that I took away from that. And also just, you know, I can drive a pretty loose car also.
Yeah. Yeah.
Counter steering and things like that. You know, I can be pretty comfortable if my car is loose in the back. So
I just recently had the opportunity to drive a two-wheel drive buggy on a loose racetrack for the first time in years, because everything's so high grip now. And it was like muscle memory came back. And it, I mean, I'm clearly not at the level you are, but it felt so nice to drive a two-wheel drive car on a loose surface and to be sliding the thing sideways and just, you know, and driving it on the throttle and all of those things that we had to do back in those days. It was really good. The other thing I just want to kind of pick out there and maybe ask you to kind of look around the sport a little bit. You just talked about being so super competitive at such a young age, you know, 13 years old, 12, 13, 14 years old. And so I'm curious about, you know, what other young drivers you see coming around now. You know, there's a whole bunch of hyper fast young teenage electric off-road guys in Europe, for example. You know, the young prodigy known as Little Bump, who's kind of racing in the US. You know, do you see some of these kind of young talents emerging, you know, that you can name that we want to kind of look for over the next couple of years? And anyone that reminds you of yourself at that age?
Yeah. I mean, as far as like in Europe, you know, I guess I'm a little bit sad to say I don't follow RC super close. You know, I think like the Hall brothers, but even like, I'm not even sure how old they are.
Yeah, unfortunately, a little bit older, yeah.
To be completely honest. But yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of young, you know, young drivers that have, you know, came through, and I think it's It's been tough, I would say, in RC because a lot of the older guys, like, we haven't tapered off
No.
as much. And so, like, I would say just now the driving level is just really, really high. So I don't want to take away, say, from, like, Kinwald, Pavitas, Saxton, those guys, back that were kind of like at the top when I started. Their performance and their level and everything was obviously really high, but I think there was fewer people kind of at that level. So now, I think there's a bigger range of people that are at the high level. So it's definitely harder for someone to come in with not as much experience. But I mean, Little Bump, he's really good. I love that kid. His dad's awesome. His mom's awesome. I've spent quite a bit of time with them. He's actually sponsored by JTP, and yeah, they're a great family, and he's a really skilled driver. Like, a year or two ago, he was pretty reckless. Just as far as, like, crashing the cars around him and things like that. But really now he drives with so much respect. I love racing with him. So yeah, I definitely think he is, as far as just me thinking of anyone, he's kind of the only one I can think of that's, like, really young, that that's doing really good. I mean, you have, like, Aiden Horn, who he was a really young racer that, came through the ranks, and now he's, finding his feet, but it took a long time. I think, even, like, Dakota, he's one that, he was good when he was really young, but to really get to, like, winning the big races, in the, 'cause when he was really young, he didn't race gas or anything, and he raced stock for a long time. And that's good and bad. I think, like, for me, I didn't go that. I think when you start with, like, electric and you start with stock, I think that doesn't do you really much good. And so, like, for Dakota, for example, like, he had no throttle control. And so when he went to mod and stuff, he was just pretty out of control, and sometimes he'd be really fast. And now he's definitely, like, managed that. And that's why sometimes, I mean, he can go just ballistically fast, 'cause he learned somehow how to, like, manage that. I would, lack of throttle control is not the right word, but he's learned how to kind of manage that, and he can have, like, crazy speed. But yeah, I think it's just different now. Like, there hasn't really been someone that's really, like, gone through the rankings super fast. Joe Bornhorst was one that went through the rankings pretty fast. Yeah, Little Bump, it's kind
Fun
of,
to
well,
watch.
the Fuller brothers too. The Fuller brothers, I
So
mean,
that's Mason and Caden. Is it Caden?
Mason's been around a pretty long time. But, now, I mean, he's definitely a contender at every race. And, Caden's a couple years younger, and he's just all of a sudden completely, like, picked his speed up. So he's probably one of the younger kids that's, going to be fighting up at the top. But yeah, I can't really think of any others.
Oh no, there's a bunch in people like Marcus Kerup in Europe are, very young and winning European championships and stuff. So on. Interesting. It strikes me there's a fearlessness, of being a 13-year-old and racing. You can drive with freedom. The other thing, I listening to your analysis of learning to drive, strikes reminds me that, I've long personally been an advocate that if you want to be competitive in the kind of say modified classes in electric, then go race modified. Don't spend too long in spec. Just move to modern, do the learning
Yeah,
there,
for sure.
because
You
otherwise you've
don't
just
learn
got to
how to
relearn.
drive at all.
Yeah, it's different.
Well, like, the big thing, you don't learn how to use the brakes. The brakes are super important, I feel like. And like racing stock, you don't learn how to use the brakes, and you don't learn any throttle control. So, like there's a kid in the US, like Matthew Gonzalez. He was a great stock racer, and he's kind of, he raced stock way too long. And, it's kind of a shame how it is in the US. Like companies will sponsor people in stock. So it's like if he wants support and to make it where he can like financially race, he can get his support in stock, but
Yeah,
he
kind of gets
couldn't if he
stuck
went and
there.
raced mod, and then
Yeah.
he raced stock too long to then when it was time to go to mod, like he just doesn't know how to drive properly with the throttle. And it's taken a lot of time. Like he is picking it up. I don't race 10 scale anymore, so I don't get to see it, and I don't follow it as closely as I should probably, but yeah, I'm like fully against stock racing.
I'll put that in the headline when we publish this episode. Let's charge on because I'm looking at the time, and we keep getting off onto these philosophical tangents, which I'm all about. But I'm really interested to kind of explore a little bit about your 8 scale world championship experiences. You raced a bunch from that the first one in Vegas. You've been racing for like a little over 12 months when you show up at the Vegas Worlds. And then right on through from there, you race in the 8 scale worlds right through until, last year. So, I mean, tell me a little bit about that first one, but then after that, maybe let's just pick out a couple and ask you a couple of things about them. So just talk to me a little bit about rocking up at Vegas for your first worlds and how that went and what it was like as an experience for a 13-year-old.
The first one was awesome. I mean, that was the first time that I got to see like international racers. I did the world's warm up, so I got to meet some of them there, but just being anything world championship, I think I knew like a little bit of kind of the meaning behind it, but I was still pretty young, just really enjoying it. The track was crazy. Like the driver's stand was crazy. A lot of that experience. I have great memories of, I mean, even just silly things. Like, I think, this is just a funny thing, but I think like, the first time I ever saw like a topless woman was like there, like you walk through the pool area to go to the track and someone from Europe, like someone's wife or girlfriend or something was like topless at the pool or something. I walked by, I'm like, oh my gosh, what is wrong with all these European people? And then, just fun times at like the Vegas Strip with the Thunder and Tiger team, and just the track was crazy. The driver's stand was super tall, and as far as the race, I mean, it went good and bad. Like I qualified 8th, which was incredible. For my first worlds, driving for 1 year to go there and qualify 8th. I don't think anyone was expecting that. Obviously, I wanted to make the main, and I was in a transfer spot to go into the main, and my steering servo broke on the last lap. And so that was a bummer. I remember just bawling my eyes out forever, like trying to walk down that driver's stand just in complete tears. I was super gutted when that happened. And it was funny because like I've had this crazy like reign through where I climbed the ranks fast, but the 8 scale worlds has been a difficult thing. So in 2000 I qualified 8th, but I didn't make the main because of the failure. 2002 in Uruguay, I just had a complete disaster of a race. Like anything that could go wrong went wrong. I went there with a broken foot. I was on crutches. My foot swelled up so big on the plane that it split my stitches, and you could actually see the bone on the flight. And so that was not that
That's an
awesome.
enjoyable plane trip, yeah.
Trying to like, seal that thing up when it finally came back down to normal size. And then, yeah, I didn't even make it to Sunday. Like, I qualified like 100th and something, and I had a mechanical and warm up, so I didn't even get to run my main. So that trip was a disaster. And then 2004 in Sweden, that track was incredible. Such a fun track. Really difficult to learn, especially coming from US. Like, that was like as European as I feel like you could really go coming, being an American. And I really started gelling with that track, and I think I TQ'd or was like second in the last round of qualifying behind Yannick. And so in my head, I was kind of like the second fastest guy at the end of qualifying. I don't remember where I qualified, but I was qualified good in the semi. I don't know, maybe like six overall or something. And was having a great semi, was leading, gonna win the semi. And we still don't, we never really knew. Like, I was gonna pit that lap. It was my last pit stop. And we don't know if I ran out of gas or if that track had a bunch of gravel. And a lot of people were getting like rocks in their car and it was flaming them out. So I flamed out the lap that I was supposed to pit for the last pit stop. And so that was super heartbreaking because, I was most likely going to win the semi. And then Yannick, he ended up winning the semi and like lapping everybody. He was a lot faster than everyone in his semi. And I felt like, to me, like me and him were about the same speed when the qualifying ended. And so he ended up getting disqualified for his tank being oversized. So that one kind of like, haunted me a little bit. Like, man, that was a good chance to win. But still didn't make the main. So then 06 was really unfortunate. 05, I had, a really breakout year. In HCO Buggy, I won every race I entered except for one, the Roar Nationals. And I swept a bunch of races, 1/8 scale and 1/10 scale, and almost won like any race I entered in 05. And then I made the switch from Kyosho to O'Donnell in 06, which was unfortunate. I wish I wish a lot of that stuff would have gone differently, but it probably did shape me to be who I am now. So you can't always change your past too much. But 06, I wanted to go to the Worlds in
Indonesia.
Indonesia. But yeah, I just wasn't like allowed to go with kind of just how everything was going on. And with O'Donnell, like it was just kind of a crappy thing. I wasn't allowed to keep my own car. And so I just wasn't allowed to go and race. So then 08, I had the O'Donnell car. And we actually had like a huge falling out shortly before then. So I didn't even want to go there. I told them I wasn't going to go there. And we kind of worked it out. So I went, had a super up and down race weekend, which it's pretty personal, but it just shows what you have to do as a racer sometimes. Tuesday, which would be the first qualifying day, maybe. My mom actually tried committing suicide.
Ouch, sad.
And so that was like super tough to deal with, and like my weekend wasn't going that good. And so I was having a bad race weekend. My mom, that stuff happened. And then the first two rounds of qualifying, I had equipment failure with like my radio gear. And it was just so unfortunate. Like, I normally don't like smash things or get mad or anything, but like, I just couldn't like mentally handle what was going on. And so I came off the driver's stand after having a DNF in my second round of qualifying. And my radio was like glitching out. So I had my module in my hand and I threw it down on the ground and like stepped on it and just like smashed it into a bunch of pieces, like back behind the driver's stand where there was no one there. So that was a really big bummer. But the cool thing was I was able to like somehow gather my crap a little bit. And you know, H-scale world, you have six rounds of qualifying, four out of the two count. So I had two DNFs, so I had to have four good ones. And yeah, I had four good qualifiers. I think I qualified maybe eighth or something, and made the final. So, you know, 8 years after my first Worlds, where I, you know,
Would
the
have,
world seems
yeah,
so easy because
that's
my first time
right.
I went there, I, you know, I should have made the main. And so it took me all the way to 2008 to actually make my first main.
It's a race in the final,
And
yeah.
yeah, I battled up front a little bit, and I think I should have been able to do a little bit better, but that car wasn't that good. And so I got fourth.
Yeah.
And
I only
yeah, so
just
then that.
recently. I just recently rewatched that A final from that 2008 Worlds. That incredible race, partly because it was the first one we had live coverage, you know, all of that. But it's an
Yeah.
incredible race, you know, and Hara wins, which is probably unexpected. And, you know, it is quite, it's worth going back. If anyone hasn't watched that race ever or for a while, it's worth finding that on YouTube and rewatching that final. It's amazing. Yeah. So where do you go from there? So 2010, we're in Pattaya, and this one, I think I remember reading an interview with you where there was a sense that this is one that got away a little bit from you in 2010.
Yeah, 2010 was definitely the one that got away. You know, I was running Kyosho and everything was going really good. I was working super hard, was really feeling good with my car. I had swept the Roar Nationals and like did all my prep I needed to do and some. I mean, I had ran a whole like mock worlds at my local track, was like ready to just make it happen there, and TQ'd. Everything was going to plan. I was running a unique kind of tire combo, and then like first Saturday main day, they had kind of like re-oiled the track or something, and so the dust wasn't really there like it was in qualifying. And I wanted to stick to my original tire plan for the semi, and in the semi, it just didn't work as good. So I still finished pretty decent in the semi. I don't remember where I started in that main, but I had a decent finish. So I was starting kind of somewhere up front, and we knew we had to change the tires, so we had to go to the AKA Impact, and I was running City Beams. And it's, I don't know how this could have even happened, but I guess there was a box of tires that was in our area that had been mismarked. So they were a super soft compound, but they had like a soft marking on them. I don't know. Somehow that set of tires got mounted. You know, I put the tires on my car. I didn't notice that they felt softer. You know, they had a green dot on them like soft compound do. And so yeah, we went and set out for the main, even the warm up. I was like, man, my car does not feel right. And I just thought it was nerves or something. So I'm like, okay, whatever, you know, just like reel it back in, you know, like this is my worlds to win. And yeah, I had a good start, like battled, me and Mayfield battled a bunch for the lead. And then about 15 minutes in, like my tires were just overheated. They were starting to wear out, and my race was kind of going downhill. And so I just struggled after that and ended up having a really bad crash somewhere in the middle of the race and actually like flamed out because I landed on these track barriers. And but still got third. So it was my best result that I've had at H-scale Worlds. But yeah, it was tough. You know, Cody ended up winning, and up till that point, me and Cody were really close friends and teammates. I helped them a lot. But things kind of changed between us after that. And so yeah, that was a really tough time. It was crazy. I didn't sleep for 4 days after that main. Just mentally, I was wrecked. I was bawling my eyes out after the race, like That was one of my toughest things to handle mentally. And yeah, I had nightmares of that race for years. I've never watched that main back. I probably never will.
No, that's probably fair. It's a race that's looked on fondly in Australia because it marks the emergence of a young Kyle McBride onto the world scene. I think he's just behind you. So, but you know, we look at that race through a different set of eyes. There's a couple of things I want to ask you about there, Jared. Over that kind of story. The first is, I think I heard you say you ran a mock Worlds event in practice back at home. So that, I guess what that just makes me want to ask is, you know, how seriously were you treating kind of practice and training and testing and, you know, in this period, which is really is the kind of height of your career, how much does practice matter and how, you know, to run a mock Worlds is an extraordinary commitment to preparing for an event like that. Is that kind of pretty typical of the way you would prepare for big races?
I did a lot of preparation and just a lot of driving. I always wanted to work on my driving. The driving was the part of RC that I enjoy the most. You know, I would work to get like a good baseline setup, but I wouldn't like chase setup stuff a lot. I just needed something that could go fast, but something that I knew what it would do. Something that I could be really comfortable with. I've always just done a lot of practice racing. So, I mean, yeah, I literally ran a whole entire Worlds event. Like I did 6 10-minute qualifiers. I did a 30-minute semi. I gave myself an hour to prep my car and I ran an hour final, you know, just me and my wife at the track.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I've done that. I've done that a lot. When I go drive, even now, still, like, I always have the clock on. Like right now I drive in 7-minute increments. I always drive for 7 minutes.
Yeah.
I don't really ever drive for less than that. Just so, like, I'm always used to kind of, like, a qualifier distance, you know? But, I've tried to have my practicing and stuff pretty structured, so.
Mm-hmm. Makes a lot of sense.
And stuff,
yeah.
I've always taken it really, really, really serious, so. Mm. Like, the Astro Worlds in 2015, that was probably my most intense preparation. That Worlds.
Yeah. I want to ask you about that race in particular in a few moments. Just before we leave the 8-scale scene, well, two other questions. Firstly, you know, in this story from 2010, in 2008, the difficulty of that week, even back to the Vegas Worlds, you know, as a young fellow, and you spoke earlier on in our conversation about being an emotional kind of character. There's a real emotional investment in, you know, for you, but probably for all of us. And so I'm curious about, you know, how do you go about trying to, in a sense, compartmentalize? I think, you know, F1 racers talk about that capacity to kind of put all their emotions to the side and just focus on the task at hand. How difficult is that to do and, you know, to kind of manage the level of emotional investment in a big race for you over the years?
Yeah, I think that's really hard. I mean, in any motorsports, that's what's hard, and that's what makes, you know, that's what makes a difference from a good person to a great person, or not person, but like a good racer to a great racer, being able to like push all that, you know, life crap aside. I mean, everyone has stuff that they're going through, you know, and so it's, yeah, you have to push all that stuff aside. And even throughout a week and even during a race, you know, like if something happens and you have to push it aside. You can't let things bother you during a race. And I think that's something I've always been pretty darn good at, is like never giving up, always kind of fighting through to like the very end, just being like mentally strong. You know, I've gone through a lot of different things in life, and I would say I am pretty mentally strong.
Yep.
And, it's definitely helped me a lot. You know, I don't know to say, like, you know, how someone is to like practice that or
Yeah.
work on
Yeah.
that. I mean, there's definitely is things to do, and there's ways to work on that if that is like a weaker part. But I would say, just kind of most of my life, I've always been pretty mentally strong. I mean, my parents were divorced pretty early. I was single child or only child, and I had to grow up pretty fast. I did a lot of stuff, on my own at a young age, and then my early adulthood was difficult. My mom, she tried committing suicide for the first time when I was 17. She tried a couple more times, when I was 18, 19-ish. My dad went to prison when I was 18, and I moved. I proposed to my wife when I was 17 years old, so that's kind of crazy. I moved across country all on my own when I was 19, and we got married at 19 years old. So, I kind of grew up fast.
Yeah.
Had a lot of like big life experiences
Yeah.
young into my life, and I it it yeah yeah made me I had to be pretty mentally strong, I would
Yeah.
say, but I was always able to like push that stuff aside, and maybe I would use it for motivation or something when I was racing. But I've always been able to like turn that side off, and just I love competition, and I can turn that focus on, and just kind of when the race starts and you're on the track, like no, no life issues can bother you during that race time,
You got to be focused. Jared, what is it? I just want to ask you this kind of bigger question, I guess, about the eight scale off-road worlds. I mean, we've got to 2010, and there's a bunch more: Argentina, Italy, back in Vegas in 2016, Australia in 18, Spain last year. But I guess what I'm curious about is, what do you think makes an eight scale off-road world so hard to win? I spoke with Mark Pavitas recently. It was a 14-year project for him before he finally won. You've talked about that kind of how elusive it was over the kind of span of your career. What is it about this race, this 1/8 scale race, this world championship race that is so hard to win?
I don't know. I think the hard part is the event's so long. So I think at least for me, I always really try to have like a whole like race event plan kind of like in my head. I try to like plan, even like setup changes, like I'll study the track it's going to be at, or and think of like how it's going to evolve and stuff. And I don't know, maybe for me, like I go back to like 2016. I think that was another world that I let get away, and I think there I was almost like, I don't know, too prepared is not the right word, but like you have so much pr I had so much pressure on my plan, and it's the event's so long, and it's like I got off my plan a little bit at the very end, like I second guessed it some, and then that kind of like ruined my race at the very end. And just like the race is so long, I think to really mentally be in it is the most challenging part. And a lot of times the eight scale worlds, and I think this is why, is like people that aren't necessarily expected to win win. And it's because I think the people expected to win, it's really difficult mentally to like be in the right place the whole time.
Yeah, it's almost a marathon. It's almost a marathon event, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, it for sure is. Yeah, it's way too long in my opinion. Yeah, it is definitely a marathon event. I mean, you get down to like 3 days of practice, and you're just like, man, like when is this gonna start, like actually start? doing something.
Let's just get on with it.
yeah. And like 10 skill worlds are the opposite. Like those, they're so quick and short, and it's, you know, it's good because you don't have so much time to overthink.
Yeah.
I think the 8 scale, you know, for me is like, I have too much time to like think. Mm-hmm. You're not busy enough during the race days. And there's just a lot of extra time at the 8 scale worlds.
Yeah. Yeah. You're only running, you know, a couple of runs a day, aren't you? So there's a lot of sitting
times
around.
A day, yeah. Yeah, a lot of time to think your,
yeah,
to overthink your choices.
Yeah. Well, the win may not have come your way at the world level, but an extraordinary achievement in, you know, in nationals and all sorts of other events in 8 scale. And I think what we'll do is put a pause in our conversation for today. It's been an extraordinary conversation ranging over that, you know, the beginnings of Jared Thibaut, the 13-year-old, the kind of journey through to 1/8 scale world championship racing, some wins along the way, some reflections on what it means to prepare, on the kind of level of emotional investment, on facing up to kind of life challenges, and of course that story about Jared's impending retirement as a pro racer, shall we say. I'm going to put a pin in it there. Jared, thank you for this first conversation, and we're going to kind of regather and talk a little bit more about 10 scale and the Neo race and some other things. For now though, Jared, thank you for joining me for this chat.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
Folks, we'll be back next week to continue the Jared Thibaut conversation. Thank you for joining me. An extraordinary conversation. I almost want to kind of go away and sit and think about some of the things that Jared and I have talked about. So thank you to Jared for joining us. Folks, thank you for being with us this week, and we'll see you next week where Jared will join me again.